and welcome to Bubbly Bibbly, the podcast about books and bubbles, literature and libations, authors and alcohol.
We love books and bubbly. We are friends who offer a curated book review section on our website and a hilarious podcast. We discuss books, drinks, and stories from our lives. I'm Rachel.
And I am Carmen. Hello, readers and listeners. This is Carmen. I am beyond excited about this episode because Rachel gave me the best surprise ever, an interview with one of my very favorite authors. I never imagined it was even possible to speak with her, but Rachel was bold and emailed her, only to receive an almost immediate acceptance. So it is with an abundance of gratitude and a lot of fangirling that I thank you for listening to this special episode. Welcome to our very first author spotlight interview. Linda Olsen is a Swedish-born novelist who lives in Auckland, New Zealand. Published in 2003, her first novel, Let Me Sing You Gentle Songs, was an international bestseller and has been translated into 15 languages. She writes in both English and Swedish. She has since published several more novels, including Sonata for Miriam and A Sister in My House. It is my privilege and honor to welcome you to Bubbly Bibbly, Miss Linda Olsen.
First off, Linda, we're all about books and bubble. So we have to ask you what you're currently reading and what are you drinking right now?
What I'm reading, I usually have several books going simultaneously, but I just felt lately and during our lockdown here, I thought I should probably try and read up on some classical works. So I'm reading Tolstoy's The Kreutzer Sonata, which is a really lovely little book. Lovely is probably not the right word. It's quite a grim book, but it makes me as a writer very humble to read a masterpiece.
And what are you drinking? But it's okay. I know we're 19 hours difference, so it's morning time, but we're not going to judge you. This is a safe place because it's 5 o'clock somewhere. So if you're having a mimosa or something, but what are you drinking?
Well, I know the French designer Coco Chanel once quoted to have said that I only drink champagne on two occasions, when I'm in love and when I'm not in love.
I love that. Yes.
But I'm not into yet drinking at 9 o'clock in the morning. No. So I'm having what is called a flat white here, which is like it's like a latte with a bit more substance. But we call it a flat white. But I do love my bubblies. But here we have our own, so New Zealand, and we're not allowed to call them champagne. But they are, I would say, as good as the best champagne. And they come either from Hawke's Bay, which is on the North Island's east coast, southeast, or from Marlborough, which is on the South Island. My favorite is a Pask brew, and I recommend it. Try it if you can get it. It's as good as any French champagne.
Oh, wonderful.
You know, I was just telling my mother this week, I do not have a refined palate at all when it comes to alcohol. And my mom said, you know, you're just very sensitive and you don't want to hurt any drink's feelings.
I think your palate is a work in progress throughout your life. I mean, I felt like you. I have a very simple taste. Mm-hmm, but I find that I've become more critical now in my old age. And when I come back to Europe and I get served sort of quite cheap wine, I thought, no, this is not good wine. It's just it happens while you keep drinking.
You
develop your taste.
Yes.
As you do in writing and reading.
Now, I fell in love with you as an author when I read Astrid and Veronica in 2013. I can't believe it's been that long ago. That's the U.S. title of your first novel. And I just fell in love with the scenery and the homes and the friendship between these two women that were so unlikely to become friends. And then I read on your blog about your relationship with your grandmothers. And it made me wonder, does that affect the kind of grandmother you are now?
Well, it's a good question. I think it does, in the sense that I wish I could be the kind of grandmother that they were. But they were, the two women were very, very different from each other. But they gave me a lot that I've taken with me, I think, into my grandmotherhood. That they gave me, my paternal grandmother particularly, gave me a really strong sense of security. Mm-hmm. And that I didn't have as a child much otherwise. And my maternal grandmother gave me the sense of longing for that I can do, I can be something more. And she had dreams. I mean, she'd always wanted to study, and that which was not possible. And I was the first person in my entire family on both sides to even go to college and then on to university. And I graduated with a law degree. And nothing like that had ever happened in my family before. So both those women were instrumental in for my getting there and doing what I did. My grandchildren have a much better start.
And how many grandchildren do you have?
Well, I'm on to five now. And the latest one was born in Sweden in August. I haven't seen other than on Zoom. That is very sad in a way. But my daughter-in-law and says that this child was given me as a comfort and a gift in a very difficult year, because not only with the virus and the world looking as it is, but that she lost her mother. But she said, this child has given me so much love and comfort and pleasure. And so, yeah, I wish.
Are all of your grandchildren in Sweden?
No, I have two here in New Zealand. And mm-hmm. And the one of them is the only girl. It's a very boy-dominated family. I have three sons. I have four grandsons and one granddaughter. So she's quite special, little Vera. She's not the kind of child I was. She's much more confident and outgoing and happy. But she brings me a lot of happiness. I mean, she gets me going, gets me to do things I don't think that I could do.
That's amazing. Well, you have posted online how to cook a New Zealand crayfish dinner.
Oh,
and
my
it
goodness.
Was amazing. First off, wonderful. I love the way you say, you know, invite six nice people. We use Swedes. I mean, I guess you could use anybody. But have you ever considered writing a cookbook? And maybe not necessarily a cookbook in the sense of here are my recipes, but you know, just being with you in the kitchen, or some kind of story that evolves around cooking or something. You seem to really know your way around.
Well, I actually read cookbooks for pleasure, not for cooking from them, but just, and there's this absolutely wonderful food writer, the American, his name is Fisher, K-M-F Fisher, I think. She only used her initials, and I think for years nobody knew if it was a woman or a man. But she wrote, just before the war, during the war, and after the war, and I think she lived into the 70s, 80s, a fantastic writer. And her books are, one is called The Art of Eating, and it's interspersed with recipes, I suppose, but it's more about writing about food and what food can do and how important food is. I mean, there's my maternal grandmother was a wonderful cook, but had very little time to cook. She had to work hard all her life and didn't have much time for cooking. But I think her way of showing love was to cook. The word companion comes from the Latin cum pane, which means with bread. So it's when you sit down and break bread with someone that you are truly friends. And that I feel a lot like that. I mean, when I cook for someone, I try to give them love, I suppose. When my second novel was published in America, I was contacted by a blog, and they asked me to provide a recipe because they post recipes by published authors. So I just picked the recipe I had that I cooked from many, many times, and I thought that was that. But I was inundated with questions about the specific questions about what kind of sugar, how much is a teaspoon, how much... And it was really, really hard, which sort of made my dream of writing a cookbook sort of be put to the side. I think it would be.
Well, you know, that's what I loved about your blog story so much, because you talked about the people as much as you talked about the food. And when you were talking about the person that you choose to be the sommelier is the most important person, it's the most active person. And then the person who's the butcher has to be the strongest, and not because of killing the crayfish, but of cutting the bastards in two. I laughed out loud when I read that.
Thank you.
And it really would.
Well, and how you go get a cheesecake, and even though it's filling, you'll walk it off.
It was a special occasion. It was a night that I will always remember.
Aww.
And that's the kind of cooking I love. I love to have my friends in the kitchen, and I like to be cooking together. And where I live here, I have an open kitchen that, and when I have guests, they're all around me while I'm cooking.
That's nice. I was going to say, this shelf behind me is all cookbooks, and most of them are from my mother. So yeah, we do a lot of that ourselves, but that's one thing that really caught my attention. And I thought, oh, she would be, it would be so good.
It would almost be a novel and not a cookbook.
Right.
Yeah. I'll give it some consideration.
It was very, very enjoyable. As a matter of fact, when I need to smile, I'll go back and read little snippets of your blog. And it's so, so beautiful. And it just makes, it's so real. It's almost like I was there, but I had to leave early. another thing about your blog is you blogged about the intensity of feelings and the pressure that you feel between books. Is that something that you place on yourself? Is that something that your publishers are putting on you? What exactly is that for you?
I think it's completely self-induced. I mean, I beg particularly my Swedish publisher, whom I like very much and who understands me quite well. And I beg her to give me a deadline, because otherwise I get nothing done. I come from a long line of procrastinators on my mother's side. We get nothing done unless there's some outside pressure on us. So, yeah, no, I struggle. I find it hard. And just today I read an interesting article by a Swedish author who said that it's so lonely to be a writer that you often feel like, what's the use? Why do I do this? I might as well stop now and go out and live in the society and with other people and not sit here in my study and try and deal with this angst and worry.
Yeah. So Carmen and I both, we've really enjoyed your blog and we've caught up and through the archives. Why did you stop blogging?
Because it was destroyed. It was hacked. And I had a call from my computer helper, and he said that I have taken it down because it's completely destroyed. And then I had my very talented niece with me here for a while last year, and she's very clever, a sort of designer and graphic designer. And she recreated bare bones for a blog, but I sort of had lost the enthusiasm, and by then I compensated for it on Facebook, where I have a separate Facebook page with my for my writing. I'm not as active there, and it's not the same as blogging, but I'll see what I'll do. So if you log in on my blogging address, you'll get just a very basic first page. That's it. And it's under development. So we'll see what I do.
I think that is where I found your blog. It was part of an archive. And so mm-hmm. I just happened upon it quite accidentally. So it's maybe your computer guy put a little bit of it out there so that it would be referenced.
Well, I like that you're on Facebook as well. I know it's not quite the same thing as blogging, but you get to interact more with your readers. Do you feel like you get to interact more with them?
I'm struggling a bit to keep up because I'm much more active on my personal Facebook, where I have lots of really good friends, both from before Facebook and new friends that I've found. And many of them are very much into books and reading. But then my professional one, I have to make an effort to actually check it every day and see and respond to readers' questions. And I have quite a following by American readers, and they often communicate with me on my Facebook.
It's because we love your writing. So.
yes. And, you know, I think I've heard of so many authors, they treat their writing like any profession. They get up and they go into their studio or their office at 8 o'clock and they don't come out until 5. But your writing seems totally different because it almost seems like these characters come to you and they grow and they form in you almost like you have to finally give birth to them on the page. And in particular, it was Sonata for Miriam. And you spoke about this story kind of coming to life and Adam coming to you and just really kind of demanding to be born. And as you were fleshing him out, You first figured out he was going to be a man, and then he was going to be a musician, and then he's Jewish. Everything that you are not. So it really is like these stories are just, they just demand for you to bring them to life. Is that the way all of your books work?
I mean, I'd say all of my books have started with the person. And sometimes I've struggled to find a time and place for that person, particularly with my third book, which in America was called The Kindness of Your Nature, where there was a main character, a woman. I had this, suddenly appeared to me, this woman, and I could understand where she was coming from, what her issues were, but I couldn't place her. So initially I wanted to go back to the 50s, and I wanted to place her on the East Coast of America, sort of, and I tried, and it just wouldn't work. And in the end, she's a medical doctor, and she lives and works on the west coast of New Zealand, on the North Island's west coast, which is a very desolate, barren, violent. The sea is very dangerous, and it was not at all what I had in mind. But I was thinking maybe Martha's Vineyard, somewhere nice, and so they don't always. I don't direct them. I don't know. And it's, sometimes it's surprising to realize who they are and how they resolve their issues. They're usually much better than I am in my own personal issues. So they come out much better than I do usually.
It seems that if you were going to put her in almost a resort type scenario in the United States, but then you displace her from her home country to another country, but not only that, put her in a very remote and dangerous place, that changes the entire trajectory of your story, doesn't it?
Not really, because she remains she's the same person. She's just in a different place in a different time. But the issues she had with her childhood memories and her relationship with her lost brother, it's exactly the same as they were on. So they are a bit like my children. They have those distinct personalities, but they're not entirely under my control.
So I want to know if you are writing anything right now.
No, I'm thinking about it, but I have a finished novel that hasn't found an English language publisher. It's been published in Scandinavia, in Germany, and it's under consideration in a few other places. But my American publisher retired at the beginning of this year, and I am between agents. So, and my New Zealand publisher is hardly publishing anything this year, so they said, it's too like your previous books. If you could write something very different, we will publish this after that. But I can't write something different. I write the way I write, and my readers expect me to write the way I do. So I thought that made me quite frustrated. And
could you tell us a little bit about that book that's waiting to be published?
It's called Hamilton Beach, and again, it deals with a character, a woman who's a bit. She doesn't have a fixed abode. She lives in France at the beginning of the book, but she's from Sweden, and she ends up in New Zealand. And you follow her over about 10 years. She meets a man in France, and he takes her to New Zealand, and then you follow what happens to them in their relationship. And Hamilton Beach is a tiny little inner city beach in Auckland where she spends an awful lot of time after some terrible tragedy has happened to her. And she finds comfort in just, she walks and sits on the beach every day, and it takes her a long time to recover and then tell her story. So
am I going to have to learn how to read German?
I was about to say.
I'm going to have to learn to read German. No, it's written. It's written. It exists in English. It just hasn't found a publisher yet.
Okay.
Like a really interesting book.
We're going to have to.
But you talk about characters, and I get very attached to them, which is making my process hard because the first book is now on the film option. And
that's Astrid and Veronica?
Oh, well, fingers crossed. We will find out a middle road that that it will actually become a film.
That's exciting that it's going to be a movie.
Yes. I'm trying to protect my the way I see the book and the personalities. And also the timeline, it takes place over a year. And then the setting is important to me, but it is. So we'll see if I can protect all of that and yet make it into a workable script.
That's exciting that it's going to be a movie.
Because as lovers of the book, we want it to be the Linda Olsen movie. Well, don't forget, Stephen King hated Stanley Kubrick's movie of The Shining. And that didn't hurt either one of them.
You can, on Bubbly Bibbly, my husband's been writing stories about different cocktails. So we just put one up about a Negroni where we were drinking it in Asheville. So you'll have to check it out.
Yeah, I think everybody should be writing in their own way,
yes.
In their own style.
That's incredible.
Everyone has a story, don't they?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And everybody has a way of telling it, whether it's a shopping list or a poem or whatever, to find your own way of expressing yourself in words. This is truly magical how words can travel. Like little black signs on a sheet of paper and someone reads it at the other end of the world. and can more or less understand what my intention with those words were. I find that so extraordinary.
You know, on one of our podcasts recently, Rachel and I talked about scenes in books that stay with you. And I wondered if, as an author, you are aware that the most insignificant scene or sentence that you write is going to resonate with someone. Even if it's not necessary to the story, it sticks with you.
You know, I had a striking reminder of that and the responsibility you have as an author, because I was in a bookstore somewhere in America on my first tour with my first book, and we were finishing and people were leaving, and then there was a knock on the door, really loud knocking, and there was a woman who had missed it, and because she had just traveled in from somewhere else, and she said, "Is Linda Olson still here?" And we let her in, and she came up and she stood very close to me and said, "How could you do this to me? Here you have created this absolutely wonderful, wonderful old woman, and then you make her do such awful things that no mother should ever. I haven't been able to sleep since I read your book." And it took quite a long while to calm her down and explain what my thinking was behind that terrible scene in that book. Mm-hmm. And people, the right kind of readers, can really come inside your book and live inside it and be very touched by it. And that's a responsibility for an author, I think.
But it's also a great motivation, because doesn't it just warm your heart when a reader really connects with what you wanted to get across?
Yeah, and then sometimes I'm delighted when they read my book differently from how I had intended it to be read.
Oh, yeah, that happens. It's
because they're in the kindness, no, in the Blackbird Sings at Dusk, it's an open ending, and readers have, depending on whether they're optimists or pessimists, they've read it very differently. And that's they're right. That's exactly what they should do. You mm-hmm. come to your text, the text, with all your life experiences and your personality, and you interpret it in your way. And that you're allowed to do that.
Well, we have enjoyed your writings, and we have truly enjoyed this time with you in this interview.
It's lovely.
So, Linda, the next time Rachel and I are in New Zealand, you may expect a knock on your door for us to invite ourselves to dinner.
I'll try and find a crayfish or two.
We would love that. Thank you for your time,
thank
Linda.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I cannot tell you how absolutely starstruck I am, and I'm sure that I'll think of a million more things at about 2 o'clock in the morning that I would have asked. But Rachel and I are truly appreciative of your time, and we thank you so much. And this will be a memory that I will take with me forever. So from the Bubbly Bibbly family, we thank you so much, Linda Olson.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been delightful, in spite of the technical problems.
And I'm still going to send you private emails about writing that cookbook.
I think you should. I'll send you some recipes.
And look up that amazing American food writer I told you about.
I wrote it down.
She's just delightful. I'm sure you would love her stories.